We're focusing today on the final major rulings by the U.S. Supreme Court this term. The court ruled in favor of a challenge to the Affordable Care Act by a privately held craft store named Hobby Lobby, whose owners objected on religious grounds to offering birth control coverage for their employees as required by the health care law. The court's decision will allow certain businesses to refuse to offer this coverage. And in another decision, the justices allowed some public sector employees to opt out of paying union dues, even if they receive the benefits of collective bargaining. The court was closely divided along ideological lines with 5-4 rulings in each case. We wanted to talk about both of these decisions and their broader implications. So we've called David Savage once again. He's the Supreme Court reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Michelle.
And for perspective on the labor issue, we've also called Stephen Pitts. He's a labor policy expert at the Labor Center of the University of California, Berkeley. Mr. Pitts, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me on the show.
And we're going to stand by and ask you to stand by, Mr. Pitts, for a minute, because we're going to focus first on that Hobby Lobby case. So, David, what kinds of companies can opt out of providing birth control coverage as a result of this ruling? I'm interested in this question of how broad it really is, because a lot of the analysts seem to disagree about that.
Yeah, so I guess we don't really know how broad it's going to be. I think the general idea is if you're a corporation and the owners have what they say is a sincerely held religious belief that they don't want to do this, they can opt out. So I think it's pretty broad, at least in theory. Practically speaking, you can't imagine a lot of big corporations in the country that have a lot of, you know, say public shareholders and a wide board of directors. They're probably not going to say, "Hey, this is not a good idea for business to be able to tell our women employees." But I think a lot of companies where it's a family, it's essentially a family run company or a family run, in this case, chain of stores. Yes, they can if they choose to. Say we're not going to offer this because it violates our religious beliefs.
So is this decision in fact limited to privately held corporations? Because I'm just trying to figure out how in a publicly held scenario where a company is owned by the shareholders who may have a wide variety of religious beliefs, how is a religious sincerity test to be determined? So is this in fact limited to people, to concerns like Hobby Lobby, which are privately held?
Yes, I think that's right. It's a privately held corporation, and even more so probably a family-run corporation, because even some privately-run corporations have a bunch of people who are the shareholders.
Do you anticipate other challenges to the law based on this ruling? I mean, are there, for example, other cases in the pipeline where people are waiting to see what happened in this case?
Yes, two kinds. There are a whole lot of cases out there, by the way, that are still pending that are religiously affiliated institutions, schools, colleges. Those are all still pending. But I also think, I mean, we don't know down the road, but I do think this sort of opens a new door. The court has essentially never said this before. So they've sort of opened this door to saying that if you as the owner have some deeply held religious belief, you can invoke that and say, I deserve an exemption from the law.
And do you anticipate that there are challenges to other areas of the law beyond the Affordable Care Act? Or do you think that that is specific to the Affordable Care Act because implicate matters of health and religion are implicated? For example, I mean, Hillary Clinton in a public address talked about, you know, what about people who have religious objections to blood transfusions, you know, for example? That's still a health area. Do you anticipate going beyond the health area? Are there challenges?
Yes, I do think down the road, it's not going to happen immediately, but I think in the next couple of years, you're going to see a lot more of these types of cases. Because as I say, they've sort of introduced a new principle in the law, because the law has always been that if you go into a public business, you've got to abide by the laws. That's what the whole principle of the Civil Rights Act is. If you go into business, then you have to abide by the Civil Rights Act. This is sort of heading the law in a different direction of saying, well, no, in some instances, owners can invoke their religious beliefs. And we don't know, but my guess is down the road, yes, there'll be other types of cases, other laws challenged.
Let's hear about the other court decision in Harris versus Quinn. And this ruling, the justices said that home health care workers in Illinois who didn't want to join the union shouldn't be forced to pay dues. And just briefly, again, you know, there's the question of whether this is a broad ruling or a limited one and with other implications. David, tell us your perspective on this.
Well, I think it's both. I think it has an effect immediately on this area of home health care, because this was sort of a growing area. These were underpaid, very often underpaid, poorly treated workers who were working in people's houses. They were paid from Medicare funds, but they were going to, say, take care of adult disabled people who were living at home. The union went in. Their wages have doubled over the last few years, brought them a lot of benefits, but you know, a lot of people don't like unions, and they had a few members who objected. And so this, I think, will make it harder for those unions to organize home health care workers. And in addition, the court's opinion is full of language questioning the whole notion of mandatory fees for, let's say, school teachers, public transit workers. All those public transit, all those public unions since the mid-70s have been able to say, look, if you're going to benefit from the collective bargaining and the benefits of the union, you have to pay some fair share, everybody. The court's opinion doesn't overrule those precedents, but Justice Alito has a lot of skeptical language that suggests down the road that's where the court's headed.
Stephen Pitts, the court ruled that home health care workers were not, quote-unquote, full-fledged public employees because they are hired and fired by individual patients, even though they are paid in part by the state through Medicaid. Are there other jobs that this may apply to?
Well, I think if you go into the area of child care, it's very similar. That could happen. And what you have here is it's a broad range of areas. Say home care is one for adults, child care is another. Where in an attempt to provide better care for consumers, you begin to have this kind of quasi-public, quasi-private situation where the dollars paying the workers come from the state, while oftentimes some of the initial interactions between the consumer and the individual worker, him or herself. And so all these areas, you find a situation where this kind of duality exists. And the Supreme Court's majority did set up this new category called partial public employees.
Hmm. Do you see broader implications for this case as well, Stephen Pitts, based on your analysis of the circumstances as well as the ruling itself?
I mean, definitely. It's very clear that Alito really does not like the Abood precedent. Kind of the legal, what's governing this is the Abood versus Detroit Board of Education ruling back in 1977 that allowed for public sector unions to establish an agency fee that would disallow individuals from receiving benefits from a union collective bargaining action when I pay for those services. And Alito really said basically that the ruling in 77 was faulty. And so clearly he both said that in this particular case, Abood should not be extended, but he opened the door for future challenges to Abood that, in his mind, hopefully they would overrule the entire case and basically gut the public sector unions.
What's the critical feature of this, Stephen Pitts, that you want us to focus on? What's the critical aspect of this case that you think has implications for the future? Is it the type of work? Is it the type of payment structure that governs the work? What is it that's relevant here?
Where there's two important things. From the point of view of workers, it's very important to understand that workers need to come together to help collectively bargain to improve their conditions. And the basic danger there is one of having a free rider. So in the case of Illinois, without the union, the wages that those workers would receive would be a minimum wage. Today in Illinois, it would be $7.25 an hour. Because of the contract, in December, it would rise to $13 an hour, a clear benefit to the worker. That couldn't occur without the collective action on the part of workers themselves. To the extent that a worker could receive that benefits, might pay for it, they begin to opt out, it weakens the capacity of unions to operate in the interest of workers and would begin to see a race to the bottom. That's one thing. The second important thing is from the point of view of consumers. Because once again, the development of these home care workers has allowed people who might normally be in institutions to be at home, which is a positive thing. And we've seen that through higher wages, there have been less worker turnover and therefore higher quality of care for the consumers as well. So from both standpoints, you see an adverse impact on both workers and consumers.
David, interesting. What do we know about these eight plaintiffs? I mean, do we know, did they have an individual antipathy toward union membership? They felt that it interfered with what their free right of association. What was their kind of motivation? Since they're clearly, I think they're not denying that they achieved a benefit.
Some of it is antipathy, but some of them is a very personal situation. I've talked to a number of them. That some of these are mothers who are raising their own, caring for their own adult disabled child at home. Mm-hmm. They have a child who's 30 years old now, disabled, and that person is working at home. And they basically think, what good does – they don't feel any connection to the union. You know, they work in their own home. It's not like working in a school or, at a transit agency. They don't feel any connection to the union. They say, I've got to pay fees, and so they really just don't like the union. There's also the National Right to Work Committee is willing to send in lawyers to fight these cases. So if you have a couple plaintiffs, You can take on a big – you only need a couple of plaintiffs to take on a big union and make a big case out of it.
David, just give us the same question I asked Professor Pitts earlier, which is, do you see broader implications or are there other cases that this precedent might affect coming down the road?
Well, I agree with Professor Pitts on this, that the big issue in unions is everybody has to be together. For the union movement to work, everybody has to join and participate and pay. If you inject the principle into the law that everybody has a right to opt out and not pay, unions really fear that that's the first start of crippling the unions. It wouldn't happen immediately, but if you can undercut the principle that everyone has to pay their fair share, it will really undercut the unions.
Just very briefly, Professor Pitts, we only have about a minute left. You know, the fact is that unions represent a declining share of the labor force anyway, so I think some might argue, how could it really have that significant effect when it's a minority of the labor force now that's unionized? Your thoughts?
The issues in the union is the quality of work for the workers themselves. And we see with the rising concern of inequality, we need to take steps to raise the quality of work for workers in our society. And unions are an important strategy to do that. And so when we begin to erode the power of unions, you're actually eroding the living standards of a large number of Americans.
But you heard David Sam say that they didn't feel a connection to the union. So was there a failure of outreach or a failure of the union to make its benefits known to these workers?
I mean, unions can do better. As I said before, though, without the union there, they would have received less monies. And they might have had actually, given the old situation, they might have had their family members in institutions themselves.
Stephen Pitts is an associate chair of the Labor Center at UC Berkeley. He joined us from member station KQED in San Francisco. David Savage is a Supreme Court reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He was with us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Thank you both so much for speaking to us.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.